identify as anything. I say it for all of eternity.
Absolutely.
However, the chances of somebody digging down deeply enough into the tape to find it are very small.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy that Matt agreed to give today's talk, a paper of Witten from 1988 about 2+1-dimensional gravity.
All right, thank you. So let me start with some motivation. So when this paper was written in 1988, there were two kind of facts, standard lore about gravity in 3 dimensions that were known by most physicists, but which seem kind of conflicting. So, the first one is that 3D gravity is trivial in some sense. So better might be topological. And I'll come back to this in a second. And the other is that 3D gravity is non-normalizable. Let me first say what these are, and then I'll come back to what the conflict is. So the sense in which it's trivial. In 2+1 dimensions, the Einstein equations, well, all right, so we have a space-time manifold, mg, it's a Lorentzian manifold, and the Einstein equation for this manifold is rij equals 2 lambda, Gij, where lambda, the cosmological constant, is just a real number. So G is the metric, R is the Ricci tensor, and so this is the equation for Einstein metrics on this manifold. But it turns out, in 3 dimensions, sort of as a consequence of the fact that the Ricci tensor in 3 dimensions determines the Riemann tensor, that any solution of this equation is locally either Minkowski, De Sitter or anti-De Sitter, depending on lambda. So, So if lambda is 0, the space is locally Minkowski. If it's positive, it's locally De Sitter. And if it's negative, it's locally anti-De Sitter. So if we think about the physical consequences of this, basically one of them is that we can't perturb away from a solution of Einstein's equation in 3 dimensions. So if you think of like Maxwell's equations in 4 dimensions, the physically relevant case, you can write down wave solutions. So basically you can perturb a solution and look at propagation of electromagnetic waves, but in 3 dimensions there's not even a way to perturb around a solution and still have a solution. So this is the sense in which the theory is trivial or better topological. Your only freedom here, if you have a classical solution, is basically just the global topology of the space-time. So that's the first statement. The second statement, that gravity is non-normalizable, I'll briefly say something about, although unfortunately the meaning of the word renormalizable is difficult. So the Hilbert action for gravity is just this. So it depends on the metric. There's some factors out front, some constants, and then you integrate the Ricci scalar minus twice the cosmological constant. Multiply that by the volume form of this metric G, and you get a form that you can integrate. And if you vary this metric to get extreme points, the equation that extreme points have to satisfy is just the Einstein equation. Right. Now, what's important here is this G. So the This is Newton's constant. And what's relevant when you're trying to determine whether a quantum field theory is perturbatively normalizable is the dimension, or rather the units, of the coupling constants that appear in the theory. So here, if you trace through, well, and generally these depend on this dimension of space-time. So if you work in natural units where h bar equals c equals 1, you find that the units of Newton's constant in three dimensions are inverse mass. And so from the stuff that they teach in QFT, you think that you're sunk. If you have a coupling constant with a negative mass dimension, you can't do perturbative renormalization. You have divergences due to high energy processes that cannot be absorbed into redefinition of parameters and addition of more interactions. So basically, at least in perturbation theory, you cannot define this theory at arbitrarily high energy scales. Or thinking in terms of a discretized picture, if you think of gravity on a lattice, you can't actually take the lattice spacing to zero. Perturbatively, at least this is what this is telling us. So what's the conflict then? Well, it's not too hard to see, I guess. How, on the one hand, do we have a theory that doesn't even have propagating solutions? It's basically just global topology. But on the other hand, is giving high energy processes that are so severe that they can't be tamed to define a continuum limit. So basically, Witten set out to determine which of these is correct. And in the formalism of this paper, it's going to fall on the side of one here, that the theory is topological, and that the non-normalizability is an artifact of the way that we were investigating perturbative renormalizability. So I'll try to come back to that at the end. So first, we need some formalism. We're going to write the variables, the fields of gravity, not as a metric, but as something else. So as motivation, suppose I'm working on an open subset of my manifold. Say now we're just in D space-time dimensions, because this part doesn't depend on being in three dimensions. And so I have coordinates on this set U, and I also have a local orthonormal frame on U. So let's call the frame vectors EA, where A goes from 1 to D. And then we have the coordinate vectors DI. I has the same range. And in general, I'll use letters like A, B, C, dot, dot, dot for orthonormal things, and I, J, K for coordinate things. Okay, so since these both form bases for the tangent space at each point, we can write them in terms of each other. So for instance, we have a relation like this, where the summation convention is enforced, where the EIA, called the Fieldbein, which means many legs, where this is a smooth matrix, well, basically it's a matrix of smooth functions that's translating from the orthonormal frame to the coordinate frame, and then vice versa. We have another matrix, let me get the indices right, and of course these things are inverse. Now, the fact that the E's are orthonormal means the fact that they're orthonormal means that G, EA, EB is eta AB, where eta is the usual Minkowski metric. And in terms of this Vielbein, that's just the statement that is this statement. And of course you can invert and move the Vielbein to the other side and get an equation for the metric in terms of eta in the Vielbein. Now since we have two frames laying around, we can do computations in mixed frames. So for instance, if I have a vector v and I want to look at its covariant derivative, I could do this in a mixed frame where I take the index on the derivative to be from the coordinates, but then the index on the vector to be from the orthonormal frame. So you get something like this. And I want to define coefficients omega omega I A B, so there's three things going on here. And I would define these coefficients so that this holds for every vector. So basically what I'm doing is looking in some sense at Christoffel symbols in a mixed basis. And in fact, from this formula you can you can write down the covariant derivative Gödel coordinates and you get a simple relationship between omega and the Christoffel symbols that I won't write down for the sake of time. Now omega usually called by physicists the spin connection. And if you write the Riemann tensor in a mixed frame, so I want two coordinate indices and two orthonormal basis indices. You have this formula, and here I'm thinking of omega I, so fix I, but let A and B vary. This is actually a matrix in the Lorentz algebra, so little SO, E minus 1, comma 1, and this is just the commutator. So this looks familiar as the kind of, well, if you had started with a connection and asked about its curvature, this is the kind of formula that you would have. So this motivates that perspective, which is what I'm going to go to now. I want to keep some of this, I think. Okay, so we can view E, the Vielbein, as being an isomorphism the tangent bundle over U to the trivial bundle over U. Now, in general, there are lots of choices of E. These things are isomorphic, but not canonically so. And a particular choice is a Vielbein. And then omega can be viewed as an SO D minus 1, comma 1 connection. Now, the last step, finally the last abstraction, is to throw away the metric on M altogether and sort of reverse this process. So say I have M just a smooth manifold. Without a metric up front. And I look at an isomorphism E of its tangent bundle with a fixed vector bundle V that you can think of as an abstract thing, whatever that means, but it's fixed. And you take V to have a Lorentz, a fiberwise Lorentz metric. And a metric compatible SOD minus 1, comma 1 connection, or instrument connection. Now, from the formula that I wrote here, basically, but inverted, I want to move the new lines to the other side. Just by pulling back, I can define a metric on M. Okay, so I can pull back this metric, and then I have, if I do that, I'll have the nice relationships between the Riemann tensor on M and this curvature that I wrote earlier. Basically, everything that we did earlier, which was local, is now abstracted up to a global form and doesn't have anything to do with coordinates or orthonormal basis anymore, but is phrased in terms of an isomorphism of the tangent bundle with some fixed vector bundle. So now, let me just get it on the board here. So we have new variables for gravity. So the standard thing is the metric. On the other hand, we can equivalently think in terms of E, and omega. The spin connection. Okay. So now let's go back to the Hilbert action. So we're ignoring the constants out front at this point. If I write the Ricci scalar in terms of my new variables, it turns out, you just do the computation, that it can be written.
So you're specializing in three dimensions. Right?
Sorry, yeah, thank you. Yes. So that was all general. At this point, the Hilbert action I'm writing in three dimensions. So there's a three here. Of course, you could change that to a D, but this you cannot. Change. This is very special to three.
So for this change variable, this metric in eta is fixed once for all, is that right?
Yeah.
So there's really only one metric on V.
Right. Okay. Okay, so we're in three dimensions and we can integrate this form over the manifold. Now this is kind of a very compact notation, but if you look in coordinates, what this is this formula, which is not so surprising, I guess, with regard to the fact that we are integrating the Ricci scalar, and we've already seen a formula for the curvature that looked sort of like this. So this is the action in terms of our new variables. And just as a check, you could vary this action with respect to the new variables and get equations of motion. And if you do that, the equation of motion you get from varying omega is this, and this is a version of, or a way of saying that omega is torsion free, and the equation of motion for E
can.
Sorry.
I can see.
Okay.
Me too.
I'll get the back of a hard time.
This equation is just a statement that this section is Ricci flat. So if we take stock of everything that's happened here, we started with a metric compatible connection that's now torsion free and Ricci flat. These are all of the conditions that you get from the Hilbert action in the usual variables, where I should have said also that at this point we're in the zero cosmological constant case, which we'll be in for basically the rest of the talk, except for maybe some remarks at the end if there's time. Okay, so those are the new variables. Everything is nice so far.
Some get them in the new variables. So this, the last R, what is the last R?
Where?
So you write the formula for, not for the Hilbert functional.
You write R.
And the last R, what is
Yeah, right, so that's... the kind of...
that's a wedge product.
Oh, right, yeah.
Well, it says F.
That's yeah, it is a wedge.
So is field bind, is it the same as to say trivialization? Are they synonyms?
Yeah, I think so.
It's the section of the frame.
Right, I mean, because I suppose that V need not actually be trivial, so then if you call it trivialization, that's a little dangerous, but that's the idea. Okay, so... move on now to gravity as Chern-Simons.
Well, now I'm confused about the notation. So E is a matrix, right?
Yeah.
How do you convert into a form? Well, when you do this wedge product, I assume you convert this into a form.
Right. So I think, this is kind of why I actually wrote it out, because there's some things being condensed in here, I think. Basically, if you take the wedge, you actually... let's see, so R is a...
Well, I think I stand. It's a matrix of a one fold.
Yeah, right. R also has indices, right?
Yeah.
So this is contracting indices.
Yeah, okay. Is that the matrix of one fold?
So for a long time, I think physicists have wanted to think of gravity as a gauge theory. They certainly do in the sort of heuristic sense that both theories have a large group of symmetries. But it would be really nice to think of it as an actual gauge theory in terms of a connection on a bundle with either the Chern-Simons or Jahn-Mills action. Now, in four dimensions, this does not work, and maybe I'll get to say something about that at the end. But in three dimensions, Witten's insight was that you could actually write gravity in terms of our new variables, classically at least, as a Chern-Simons theory. So let me do that now. So first I'll have to say something about the Lie algebra of the Poincaré group. So I'll let ISO 2,1 denote the Poincaré group in three dimensions. And with lowercase letters, the Lie algebra. Now this Lie algebra you can take as a basis for the Lie algebra vectors PA in anti-symmetric tensors JAB, where A and B go from 0 to 2. Now, something special about three dimensions that physicists are probably used to is that we can swap out anti-symmetric tensors for what we would call axial vectors. So I can define J with one index to be this quantity where I contract a Levi-Civitas symbol with, with the anti-symmetric tensor. Okay, and now I can write the brackets for the Lie algebra in terms of these P's and J's.
this is just a fancy way to say S of 3 is three dimension? How many you wrote down? Just saying S of 3 is three dimension.
Yeah. So the brackets. Okay, so the P is commute, the commutator of J to P is written in terms of P's, and then commutator of two J's is also a J. So this is one thing that we need to know to write down the Turn-Simons action. Another is we need an adjoint action invariant inner product. Trace, say, on the algebra. Oh, I should also say, so this looks just like the Lie algebra of the Euclidean group. The fact that it's not is hidden in the indices. So the indices are raised and lowered with the Lorentz signature form, not the Euclidean one. So just a note. Okay, so we want an inner product on the Lie algebra that's invariant of the adjoint action of the group. It turns out that one is given by these equations. So the product of a J and a P is just the Kronecker delta. And then just to save time, I'll say all others are zero, meaning J's with J's and P's with P's. Okay. And now we define. ISO 2, 1 gauge field A, which I'm going to write things in coordinates again, to be this field bind where I contract the A with a P and the spin connection, and I've lost an index, I'll explain that in a minute, where I contract with J. So omega IA is, well, it's basically the same thing that I did over there. It's 1/2 epsilon ABC omega I BC. Okay, so omega was already an SO 2 comma 1 connection, so it seems natural to pair it up with these rotation, or, you know, Lorentz rotation generators. And then E sort of furiously has something to do with infinitesimal translations, so why don't I stick it with P? That's kind of the philosophy. But what is more motivating is that it actually works, so let's look at that. Okay, so I have a gauge field, so I can write down the Turn-Simons action. Okay, so what's going on here? When I wedge product these gauge fields, I'm taking the tensor product of their Lie algebra part. So, for instance, A wedge A is a G tensor G, where, well, I erased it, I'm going to say G for ISO 2 comma 1, to not have to say that all the time. That's a two form value G tensor G. The bracket means I apply the Lie bracket to this tensor, and I get a two form that's just value G. Now the trace is basically doing the same thing, except instead of applying the bracket, I apply the inner product. So when all is said and done, the thing in the integrand is actually a three form you can integrate over the manifold. And,
excuse me, so yeah. Which part is the differential form part? Which part is the gauge rule part? You should have the differential form along the base manifold. You should have a fiber part.
I don't know if I exactly know what you mean. I guess I would think if I was thinking in terms of bases and fibers, I would think that omega was had something to do with Lorentz transformations in the fibers, and E had something to do with translations of the base or
different. So
the
P denotes like bases on the tangent manifold, base manifold, and J denotes the cool action part.
Are you saying, so P was just an element of this Lie algebra, like in the abstract. Sorry, I don't think I understand what you're asking.
You're working on manifold M, right? So I wonder what's the relation between P and G with the differential forms on manifold M.
Well, so A is a G-valued one form on M. I don't know if that answers your question.
So I mean, P is also like a G-valued form or not?
P.
Or E is like.
E's and omegas are forms.
Oh, yes. I see. E and omega are forms.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so if you go through and compute this. Last night, and I couldn't find a factor of two, but otherwise, this is the result. I mean, the three, you know, you get a cancellation with the three, and it's very nice, and so, okay, it can be done, I think. So right now we're working in terms of omega with just one, you know, ABC index, because we made this definition. But if we put back in omega IAB, and rewrite this. I don't want to write it down just to save time, but the result is it's exactly the thing that I wrote for you earlier. So it's this wedge product, which is exactly the Hilbert action in terms of the new variables. So at least in terms of the field variables and the action, classical three-dimensional gravity Use turn assignments theory. So the last thing, if you were careful, that you would check in order to be confident about your statement that 3D gravity classically is turn assignments, is that the symmetries agree. So on the gravity side, we have diffeomorphisms and local Lorentz transformations. Local Lorentz transformation means an isomorphism of the tangent bundle of the manifold that doesn't move the base. So basically, you're just acting by Lorentz transformations in the fibers. So, all right, on the one side, we have diffeomorphisms, local Lorentz transformations. And on the Chern-Simon side, we have gauge symmetry. So if you were careful, you would go through and see that actually the action of diffeomorphisms and Lorentz transformations on omega and E can be interpreted as gauge transformations on A and vice versa. That's kind of a tedious thing, actually, so I'm not going to go through it, but it's in the paper if it's something you're interested in. Okay, so that's it, classically. Classical gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions is Chern-Simon theory. So now we want to move on to quantization. But actually, before we can do that, I have to talk more about classical mechanics.
Before you continue, you said it, you did the computation, you missed a 2. It's not the 2 in the front, it's the 2 in the 2/3. That's the problem.
Let's see. I think so, yeah. I think it was this 2, right?
Maybe just the inner product, then. Could be just the inner product.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. All right, so the idea is that if we are very careful on the classical side of things and define a classical phase space in the sense of Hamiltonian mechanics and then a classical configuration space, quantization becomes not so hard. If you think about classical mechanical systems of finitely many particles, the phase space is just R2n, where you have half the coordinates are positions and half them are momenta. The configuration space is just the positions, the x's. And then the quantum Hilbert space is usually an L2 space of some kind of, in the case of Rn, it's just L2 of Rn, the square integral functions of the positions, so position wave functions. Or you could alternatively pick out the momentum slice and look at momentum wave functions. Or you could look at things in terms of holomorphic. You define complex coordinates and look at holomorphic functions that are square integral with respect to some measure. That's common in the study of the harmonic oscillator, for instance. But the point is that basically you define a phase space, you pick out some half-dimensional slice as your configuration space, and then the Hilbert space is L2 of that. So that's what we're going to do. Okay. So this is canonical quantization. So I should say first that an alternative way to view the phase space instead of positions of momenta is as space of classical solutions. So solutions to the equations of motion. Modulo the symmetries of the system. So this is very nice and covariant in some sense, but it can be challenging to work with. So often, instead of working with this whole space, we impose constraints. For instance, in gauge theories, you often, you basically have too many components of the gauge field, they're not all independent, so you might impose a constraint like that the time component is 0. So this is called temporal gauge, I think. And if you do this, you can view the phase space instead as the space of solutions to the constraint equations. But you usually have some residual symmetry. Your constraint equations don't pick a single representative of every equivalence class under symmetries. There's usually some residual symmetry, so you have to mod out by that. So we're going to take this tack and impose a constraint that basically, viewed from the Chern-Simon side, is temporal gauge. It's basically that the time component of the gauge field is 0. Expressed in kind of a covariant way. So the first step, I'm going to say some of this stuff in words because some of the equations are long. I mean, if you want me to write them, I'll write them, but we'll start with words. So the first step is to introduce loop variables in the action, if necessary, to obtain a Lagrangian that's linear in all time derivatives. Now, if you actually write out the action, it was kind of this big long thing, and we needed to separate the time piece, so it's really long. But the point is that it's already linear in time derivatives of the fields, so we're not. Okay. Next, you separate these time derivatives away from the spatial components, and in fact, just the time components away from the spatial components. And from that, you can read off Poisson brackets. So a key ingredient, I should have said, in phase spaces is that they are, well, usually we say they're symplectic manifolds, but you can even be more general and say that they're Poisson manifolds, so they need some Poisson brackets. And basically, let me write that part of the action. So this is so abstract. So the action this is all where I'm assuming that M is a Riemann surface cross R. So sigma it's closed orientable genus at least 2, and that condition won't appear at first, but it will later. So that's why I have this separation into a time interval and an interval over sigma. Okay. So this is the part of the action that has time derivatives. And if you kind of compare this to what you would expect in classical particle mechanics, you would expect a q dot, time derivative of a position with momentum multiplying it, and you expect these coordinates to satisfy, or their Poisson bracket is 1. And so basically we do the analogous thing here. I pretend that omega is like q, everything else. I think I left something out, yeah. I forgot a Bielbein. So omega is q, everything else is p, and then I just read out the Poisson brackets. So in this case, that's that omega I a of x, pjb of y is 1/2 times this epsilon tensor, have a Minkowski metric, and then a delta function. So this is the classical field theory version of the Kronecker delta. Okay, so we actually won't need the Poisson brackets really anymore. I just wanted to emphasize that you do have to pay attention to what they are and that we do have them. So, okay, so we have Poisson brackets. The next step is to determine the constraints. So the formalization of temporal gauge is that when you hear the action with respect to the time components of the fields, you get 0. And now we have the action. I didn't write down the part that's relevant for this computation, but basically this just amounts to reading off the coefficient of E0A and omega0A in the action, and you get, for the first one, I'll just write down the first one. Second one. And now the idea is to do what we did before, combining E and omega into a gauge field, but now one on sigma. So we can view EIA PA plus omega IA JA as an ISO 2 from a 1 connection, not on M, but on sigma. And then these two equations actually end up being with the connections flat. Okay, so the constraints for this system are that this connection is flat. And then the symmetries, residual symmetries, are just still gauge symmetries. So whatever gauge symmetries are left over after the constraints, we need to keep track of. So our candidate for the phase space, well, I should say actually, there, you kind of have to be careful about that statement, that the symmetries are gauge symmetries. He had a discussion of this, but I'm just going to say the punchline. The candidate for the phase space is the moduli space of flat ISO 2, 1 connections on sigma, the Riemann surface, the spatial slice, modulo gauge transformations. Okay. So that's the candidate for the phase space. I'm calling it a candidate because actually there's an alteration that I'll have to make of a topological nature, but we can't do that until we talk about the configuration space. So that's next up. So the configuration space, like I said, basically is a choice of which of my coordinates am I going to call positions and which ones am I going to call momenta. The half that I call position, I'm going to say form the configuration space. Now, from the Poisson bracket and from the action, the choice is really not clear. I mean, I erased the Poisson bracket, but neither omega nor E necessarily look like an obvious coordinate and the other like an obvious momentum. So what we do is appeal to the symmetries. So I'll be very schematic here. Something I didn't write down earlier. If you look at the effect of an infinitesimal gauge transformation on E, schematically, the result depends both on E and omega. So, of course, it's not actually E plus omega, but it depends on them being schematic. But the gauge transformations on omega only depend on omega. Now, if we want a configuration space to play nicely with the symmetry, it would benefit us to pick as the coordinates the ones that aren't taken out of the space by the symmetry. So this tells us that omega should be the coordinate, or the coordinates, and E should be the momentum. Now omega was just an SO2, 1 connection. On sigma, not ISO2, right? So this was the SO2 part, and E was giving the translation part. So this tells us that our configuration space should be the moduli space of flat SO2, 1 connections up to gauge transformations. But again, this is just the candidate because there's this topological issue that I'll discuss now. It turns out that N, this moduli space, actually has several connected components that are characterized by the Euler class of a bundle in of a representative of one of the elements of this moduli space. So,
I have a question.
Yeah.
So we choose this polarization of the phase space, which is your M. Should we consider, you know, splitting the position momentum on that space M rather than on your coordinate? You know what I mean? But the real space we want to quantize is M, right?
Well, right. So it is M that we're trying to give a splitting into position momentum.
But you are splitting using kind of like something slightly different, using timeline variable or something. You know what I mean? This EW, this modular space is representations of something, right? So that's the space which we split into position and momentum.
M, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's right.
But this E and M, they are not really, you know, flat connections on something, right?
Well, okay, so I think E by itself, yeah, you shouldn't really think of it as a flat connection, but I think omega, the point is that omega by itself can be thought of as an SO2 comma 1 connection. Yeah. So what we're doing here, at least maybe after this topological issue, is something that's, I guess, standard in geometric quantization. I don't know much about it, but basically choosing what's called a polarization of the phase space. So this is the simple case, actually, in geometric quantization, where you can choose the configuration space to just be some n such that its cotangent bundle is the phase space.
Oh,
and it turns out that works here, at least after I do this topological thing.
That's experimental.
So n has connected components. Classified by an integer n, where the absolute value of n is at most 2g minus 2. So basically what's going on here is that in each component we have vector bundles with different Euler classes, and you dualize the Euler class to get a form that you then integrate over the manifold to get an integer, and these are the distinct integers that you can get. So we can define n prime to be the component with maximum Euler class in this sense, where we're thinking of it as an integer. So that's 2g minus 2. And this will be the final configuration space. And then, of course, since I modified the configuration space, I have to go back and modify the phase space. And so I guess it's just the obvious thing. Now, why do we want to do this?
Final question.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know if we'd explain in this paper. So there's another canonical choice, which is you choose n equals 0.
Oh, I see, okay.
Well, just you need to choose something, right? So this is a canonical choice. There's another canonical choice, which is n equals 0. Did he explain why you didn't choose that one?
Well, he says why he did choose this one, which I guess maybe we'll explain that. So yeah, I'll say something about that.
Are you aware of the time, by the way? I mean, you can go on past 5, but...
It's like 4:50, right?
Yeah, 4:54, yeah.
Oh, okay. No, that's all right.
There's a lot of stuff to cover in one talk.
Yeah, it's a huge paper.
So, N, which is this moduli space of flat SO2 comma 1 connections, it turns out you can view in the following way. So it's flat SO2 comma 1 connections. It's also moduli space. I don't know if moduli space is a term that's used in this context, but we are modding out by something, so that's what I'll say. Of homomorphisms, sigma. Homomorphisms from the fundamental group of sigma into SO2, 1. modulo conjugation. So unlike the Euler class case, I can actually kind of explain this, which basically it's, you look at holonomy. So if you started with a connection, you can look at the holonomy around a loop. And if the connection is flat, then the holonomy doesn't depend, or so I should say only depends on the homotopy class of the loop. So this map from loops to elements of SO2 comma 1 factors through the fundamental group. And then it's a homomorphism by standard stuff. If you go around two loops, that's the same thing as going around one and then multiplying by the other. So you get a homomorphism. And then the up-to-gauge equivalence part of the connections, well, if we do a gauge transformation on a connection, we conjugate all of the holonomies by a fixed element of SO2 comma 1. So that's why we're modding by conjugation here. And then vice versa is basically the statement that the holonomies determine the connection, and that's from passing the universal cover, and I won't talk about that, I don't really have time, but that's the idea. Okay, so that's N. Now the amazing thing that I cannot motivate at all, I have no idea why this is true, is that N prime, the component of N with maximal Euler class, is homomorphism in the space of homomorphisms into SO2 comma 1 that embed the fundamental group, so let's call these homomorphisms 5, they embed the fundamental group of sigma as a discrete normal subgroup of SO2 comma 1.
Discrete normal or discrete? Did he say normal?
That's a good question, actually. I haven't thought about it, so maybe to be safe.
Well, we talked about yesterday, we just said discrete, which sounded right to me.
I'm actually, now that I think about it, I'm not sure if I'm normal, but it won't matter. I was thinking the wrong thing. I thought I wanted to take a quotient by it, but I actually don't want to take a quotient in a group. I want to take a quotient on a space. So yeah, that doesn't matter. Okay, so, thanks. They embed the fundamental group as a discrete subgroup of SO2 comma 1. So in particular, for genus greater than or equal to 2, which is the case that we're in, and this is why I restricted to this case, we can view sigma as the quotient of the upper half plane by the image of phi. So to unpack that a little bit, SO2 comma 1, let's say, SO2 comma 1 is isomorphic to SL2R, which acts on the upper half plane in the hyperbolic model by isometries. And so I can think of quotienting out by this subgroup of isometries, and I get back sigma. So the idea is that N prime is exactly the space of classical field configurations from which I can recover the spatial manifold topologically. So that's the motivation for choosing maximum Euler class. But like I said, I have no idea why this statement about N prime is true. So. Okay, I do not have a lot of time, so let's see what I want to prioritize.
You can kind of just ask, so the discreteness you need, so that just the quotient has nice topology, or?
Yeah, so it's a manifold.
Well, if just discrete is not enough, you need also the average co-compact, right?
Right, yeah.
A little bit more.
I don't think he
doesn't
talked about
it. It doesn't fall from discrete?
It might, actually.
It might?
For this.
It could be in this particular group.
Yeah. It could, yeah. there was a cusp, then you would have a different fundamental group, right? So it may be a property of this group. That,
okay. Yeah. It could be the spectrum.
Okay, so the idea is that with this new description of n prime, we can easily define L2 on n prime. So we say the Hilbert space is L2 of n prime, which means basically, so an element is a function of 2G variables so these are coming from the usual presentation of the fundamental group as being generated by 2G variables with one relation, which is that the product of commutators is trivial. Okay, so these functions depend on 2G variables such that the variables are coming from embedding these concrete cycles on sigma into SO2 comma 1, so they should also satisfy this product relation that the product of commutators is 0, or 1. We should have that psi is invariant under conjugation by a fixed element of SO2 comma 1. That's coming from this part. And then finally, and this is kind of the most, the hardest condition to get a hold of in some sense, the U's and V's should define a homomorphism of the fundamental group into SO2 comma 1 with no kernel and discrete image. And that's just what I said here. Oh, and finally, well, of course, the namesake of L2, square integral of psi with respect to the restricted Harmon, should be fine. And that's it. That's the Hilbert space. And the benefit of this perspective with these homomorphisms is that it's fairly concrete, as opposed to if it were a moduli space of bundles, I guess it might be a symplectic manifold, and then you have a volume form. But that's a little bit more abstract. So this is a very, very concrete description of the Hilbert space. And I think I should, 505, I should set you guys free. So thanks.
Questions, Matt? I guess we asked all of our questions during that.
Okay. That's fine.
Let's thank him again.